Good morning, everybody.
Well, I guess it's time, huh?
My name is Charlie Bree, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My home group is the Ironwood Group from Gary, Indiana, and my sobriety date is January 3rd, 1990. You know, when I got the letter to do this, I had to call my wife and make sure it was for me. I thought maybe they delivered it the wrong place, so I'm truly honored. Okay, may we please have a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries over the last 75 years. Thank you. The topic of this is identification, why we must identify. And when I first sit down and thought about it, I got the big book. And, you know, I thought of a story that happened to me recently, and I think it exemplifies why we should identify even better than something I could have looked up. I recently had the good fortune, or not, well, let me start here. A member of my home group, Big Ed, asked me to be his best man at his wedding, and that was an experience. But in the packet that he gave to the best man was a fob with a 20-year medallion. So I wear it on my belt buckle. I recently traveled to Guatemala, and we did social work in the mountains with Mayan Indians. And I was standing there, and this guy comes over, and he goes to talking to me. Come to find out, this guy's name was Gus. He has 12 years sober. He had gotten sober in Guatemala City, which is the capital, but he had moved to the mountains, and he was staying in a little village called Pueblo Nuevo. Gus rides around his village on a scooter, and he was passing out a pamphlet he had made up of his own with his own story on it, trying to get people to come to AA. I was able to come home, and thanks to Area 22 and District 3, I've gotten together a big bundle of Spanish literature that I'm going to send back to Gus. And I can't help but feel that because I identified myself through that fob, anybody that he'll be able to help, a little bit of will come from that. So I don't think anything else could explain or exhibit the idea of why we should identify more. All right. First, our first speaker today is Erica C. from Middletown, Connecticut.
My name is Erica. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really honored to be here, and I also got the letter and was a bit stunned and sat back on the couch and thought, this is probably the most important thing that's ever happened in my life. And so I'm really grateful that GSO asked me to do this, and I'm really grateful to old friends and new friends who are showing up today to have this meeting together. And my sobriety date is December 12th of 2001, and my home group is the primary purpose group in Middletown, Connecticut, and we meet on Monday and Friday nights at 300 Washington Street and at 7:30, and we'd be happy to have any of you come to visit anytime. And I wanted to first say that I've been very moved by this weekend. It's been, you know, really great and powerful for me. And I also understand what it can be like to be like a few years sober and show up at a place like this and not feel like you relate to people, even though you're one of us, and to sort of feel lonely and stale in your program. And so if you're one of those people that's here and you don't feel like you fit, like you're not alone, you know. There are other people that way too. And the beautiful thing about the 12 steps and our message is that it doesn't matter how far down the scale you've gone, sober or out there, that there's hope for you too. And there are people who have experience, like me, with being a few years sober and feeling that way. And I don't feel that way anymore. So I want to talk about identification and how it saved my life. And I guess that's why it matters to me. When I was out there drinking, for some reason, I had a tough time identifying as an alcoholic. Like, I knew that alcohol was a problem. I guess I didn't know what alcoholism was. My experience of alcohol was that once I took a drink, I experienced a really great sensation that was extremely short-lived. And what it was as they talk about ease and comfort, I would take a drink, I would get that ease and comfort. It was immediately, like, slammed to the side and replaced with urgency to get the next drink. So every time I took a drink, I always wanted another one. And that was every time I drank. I didn't always get drunk when I drank because of circumstances. Sometimes I got kicked out of places before I was done. But actually, or run out, which is the worst, you know, when you run out and you can't get more. But I always felt like I needed another one. And I thought everybody felt like that, and that some people were just better at turning that off or, you know, just ignoring it, and that I wasn't good at that, which is true. And then the other thing is that, you know, toward the end of my drinking, when people would ask me if I could moderate or stop altogether, I didn't realize I couldn't, so I would try, and I would do it for, you know, 2 or 3 days. I would take a break, and then maybe on the second or third day, I would decide that because I had gone a couple days without a drink, I could drink again because I wasn't an alcoholic. So the information wasn't there. Even if it was there, I couldn't relate to it and so forth. So ultimately, you know, I got to that place we get to where I felt like drinking was killing me, but if I didn't drink again, that I was going to die, you know. Like, I needed it, and it was killing me. And I was living with some non-alcoholic people. I was in college at the time, and I had 5 roommates. And these were all ladies that didn't relate at all to alcoholism, but knew that there was something definitely wrong with me. And so they were asking me to not drink, and I was trying to, but would always decide after a few days to drink again. And so behind my back, they consulted a member of AA. They were meeting with him for a few months while I was in my bottom. And what he told them was exactly what it talks about in our chapter, Working with Others. He said, you know, don't really mention me. When she's on her knees begging for help, mention that you have a contact who is a recovered alcoholic who, as part of his recovery, tries to help other alcoholics stop drinking, and just ask her if she'd be interested in talking to me, and just leave it at that. And I came home after, you know, having a horrible night. I was drunk. I was on my knees begging for help, and it was, you know, very inglorious. And they said, you know, we have this guy we've been talking to. He's a former alcoholic, they called him, or something like that. And they said he has 20 years without a drink, and as part of his helping himself, he tries to help other alcoholics. And would you be interested in meeting with him? And I said, sure. I had been to a therapist in one period where I'd been trying to stay sober on my own, and it was like a 10-week white-knuckle period. And the therapist told me that in AA, you know, alcoholics get a lot of help from each other. She called it a self-help program, and she said that it's spiritual in nature, and that people find a spiritual connection and they don't need to drink. And I remember looking at her like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And whatever you are talking about, it sounds like a pansy thing, and I don't want anything to do with it. Like, it sounds like a feel-good thing. And as you can tell, I don't feel very good. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want anything to do with it, and I never saw her again, and whatever. Now, the key thing is that I want to be really explicit about is that I think therapy is awesome, and I don't want to knock it. But when she said that, a therapist who wasn't an alcoholic, and she described our program to me, it was a turnoff. It's because of where I was. I couldn't identify, basically. I went to see this alcoholic that had, 20 years sober. And I met with him and walked into his house, and he said basically the same thing that therapist said. But instead of saying they do this, he said we do this. And he said, he described his drinking. It sounded just like mine. I'd never heard anybody talk like that, you know. And then he said, I found a spiritual release from the obsession for alcohol in AA. And I worked the 12 steps. And he's a priest. And he said, I didn't have a God that worked for me until I worked the 12 steps. And now I have a God of my understanding that, you know, I don't have to drink, basically, because I am so happy and free in my life. And when he said it, I looked at him, and I could tell he was telling me the truth. Like, he was sitting there at peace. He wasn't shaking or rocking or sitting on his hands. He was completely free from alcoholism, you know, in that moment. And I totally identified with his drinking, and I totally was attracted to the solution. And it's the same solution the therapist had told me. But for some reason, when the alcoholic said it, I totally felt it in my guts. When I left his house, I went back to my roommates and told them that I had a lot of hope. You know, here was this guy. He just told me about this solution that he practiced. And they said they were really happy, and what was I going to do? And I said, he recommended I go to an AA meeting, so I'm going to do it on Friday. This is a Tuesday night or something. And so they said, that's awesome. And I said, yeah, I'm super stoked about it. And I said, I have to go return this library book, and I'll be back in a little bit. And I walked out the door, and my feet took me right into the liquor store. And before I knew what I was doing, you know, I poured that alcohol down my throat in a locked room so no one could interrupt me. And then I came home hours later drunk, and my roommates were like, what happened? And what happened was powerlessness. You know, like, I identified absolutely. I had hope, and that's not enough. You know, like, it wasn't enough for me to get that identification. But what it did was save my life, because it attracted me to AA, where I got the solution, you know. I did go to that that Friday night meeting. It was the first meeting of AA I walked into. It was a men's meeting. And I started at 7, and I arrived at 7:30. And so they were mid-seventh step discussion. And I walked in, and they just looked at me, and they had a couple, and then they opened the meeting. That was their group conscience. They opened the meeting, and they stopped, they closed the literature, and they went around the table and told their stories. And this guy said, they were all, you know, mid-50s or older, and they were, I was 21 at the time, and they told me exactly, you know, what it was like for them, what happened to them, and what their lives were like today. And I had the same experience as I did with Father Ken, which is I looked at them, and they weren't fighting. They were actually smiling, but they were talking about my drinking. And I was completely attracted to them, and I wanted to come back the next week, but they told me that there was a young people's meeting after, and that would probably be better. And I didn't totally not get why. Because I really liked them, and I wanted to come back the next week. In fact, I think I did come back the next week. And I think they told me, you know, you should hang on. There's a youngsters meeting after this, you know. And I think after that I got the picture. But it was, you know, the young people were different than the men's meeting. For one thing, there were women. But I also, you know, when they came in, I put up that wall because I was really afraid that I wouldn't fit in with them. So what happened is there was this, I went to a meeting that was far away from the campus because I didn't want to run into anybody I knew. And the first kid who walked in the door was this guy I knew from college that I couldn't stand. His name was Todd, and I was just like, if there's one person that I didn't want to see me is this guy, because he always blows me off when I invite him to my parties, you know? And I thought it was really rude. And so he walked in, and it turns out he had 8 years at the time, as I do now. And he didn't say much to me. He just kind of nodded across the room. I went to that young people's meeting for 3 months, and by the end of that 3 months, after going to one meeting a week and doing pretty much nothing else but sit in my room and play sad songs on the guitar, I was really desperate and in pain and basically suicidal. I was in Dayton, Ohio at the time, and I went to Washington for this conference, and there were a ton of people in this room at this speech, maybe 1,200 or so. And I was walking around in the back feeling so uncomfortable in my own skin, I couldn't stand myself. And the thought came that it would probably be good to just put myself out of my misery, you know, just end it. Death is better than this, you know, the life without alcohol and without a solution. And right when that thought came to me, Todd turned around. He was right in front of me, even though we were in Washington, D.C., at a totally non-AA related activity. And he looked at me and said, "Wow, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, you know," he said, "Well, how are you doing?" And I said, "I'm feeling like I'm going to die." I just told the truth. He's like, "Yeah, I've been there. And why don't we just hang out the rest of the weekend?" And we got back to Ohio after that weekend. He introduced me to his girlfriend, Angie, and she became my first sponsor. Angie and I are 180 degrees apart in every possible imaginable way. If you look at me and you imagine the exact opposite in every possible way, that's Angie. And she was perfect for me. Just like the men in the men's meeting, the identification around that phenomenon of craving and about the peculiar mental twist, which I so related to, she told me about that in herself. She also did me the huge favor of distinguishing how that's not normal drinking, which I didn't realize, you know. And she talked about, you know, things like, "Have you ever opened the fridge and noticed that there were only 3 beers left in the fridge?" I said, "Yeah." And she's like, "What do you feel?" And I felt total panic and that we have to go on a beer run now. And she said, you know, normal people never open the fridge and see 3 beers and hide them behind the jelly jar and say, "We have to go on a beer run now." You know, they don't do that ever. You know, they never experience that. So I actually didn't know that. It was news to me. And she talked about her drinking. She talked about her character defects. And I was right there with her, you know, in every way that she was perfect for me. I suffer from, you know, pride and arrogance of an unimaginable quality. And she could help me see that by showing it to me in herself, although I don't want to take her inventory, but she was very good at expressing that to me. And I want to talk a little bit about what it's been like with me identifying with, you know, the people I work with as a sponsor. Angie took me through all 12 steps, and then I moved to Colorado for graduate school after 9 months. And when I got to Colorado, my new sponsor, Kathy, who's still my sponsor, she basically told me that I needed to be working with others. Like, if I'd been through all 12 steps and I wasn't working with others, I missed the boat, you know? So I started raising my hand. I had this weird idea that I had to have a year before I started working with others. She's like, "Man, you've been through all 12 steps, you know." So I started raising my hands, and I got working with people pretty soon after that. And what happened was, when I started talking about my drinking to them, I feel like I actually truly fully conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. The first time through the steps with me, you know, with my first sponsor, I got a very superficial level of understanding about the disease. You know, I could identify behaviors that I had that maybe reflected that I had the alcoholism. But when I started explaining to the people I sponsor what it looked like, and I saw them sit back and think, "Whoa, you just blew my mind, because that's exactly what I do," and I had no idea it was abnormal, I started to feel it in my insides that I was truly an alcoholic, you know, and that thank God somebody had taken the time to sit down with me and arm me with the facts about myself, you know. In the book, it talks about how an alcoholic who's, you know, properly armed with facts about ourselves, we can be uniquely useful to other people. And I'd experienced that because nobody else was able to be useful to me saying that information to me until it was a drunk saying it. Because Angie had distinguished between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic, I felt like I had been, you know, at least partially armed with facts that I could then express to other people, and they got it too. And the key thing was, wasn't just like, yes, I drink like that. It was, wow, if you drank like that and I drink like that and you're sitting there at peace, I can sit there at peace. You know, and so it's that that hopeful message that I've been where you are and I'm not there anymore, you know. And there's only one way to convince people that you've been where they've been, and that's to be brutally honest with what it was like and what happened. And it talks about telling people exactly what happened with us. And there were a few things that I didn't really want to talk about. Like, I didn't really want to talk about some of the ways I harmed people. It was, you know, I was ashamed. But because I've been able to tell people about stuff during their fifth steps, they've been able to lead stuff with me during their fifth steps. And that's only because of identification and the courage that it gives one another. So, okay, let me talk just really briefly and probably finish on this note about being a few years sober and feeling like plateau. So I had the experience before of kind of that second surrender in sobriety. I'll probably have it again. multiple times, I expect. What it felt like was I was coming to meetings. I was doing everything that was suggested. I was sponsoring a ton of people. I was doing service in my group. I had a ton of friends in AA. I was maybe a little enmeshed. Doing prayers in the morning, bucket prayers, like down on the knees, repeating the same prayers as every morning. And just kind of feeling ill at ease. I didn't really want to come. Well, I went to meetings, but I didn't really want to go because I didn't want to hear people talk about happy, joyous, and free. Because I had done it, and I wasn't happy, joyous, and free. And I'd been there before, and I was mad that it was gone. You know, there was unmanageability in my life and stuff, and I don't know, I was maybe 2-something years sober when this first came up. And my sponsor invited me to an area assembly. And it was in Colorado, and I was in a home group that was great and didn't have a GSR yet, and so they made me the GSR, and I went to the area assembly. And I walked in there, and there were, like, you know, 1,000 or so people who were coming down from all over Colorado to meet for a weekend and discuss the business of our area. And they actually assigned me to a small table that was discussing the fourth concept. And it totally blew my mind. You know, they're talking about all these principles that I hadn't really accessed yet, but was really inspired by. And So I got involved. I got a service sponsor. I started going through the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts, and it completely blew open the really small sober world I was living in that I put myself in. And I continue to try to carry that to people because, you know, I think that I think that it saved my life. You know, like, I think the 12 steps are life-saving and life-giving. I think the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts just make the world so much bigger for us. And they give us a place where we can continually grow. How am I doing? Do I have a couple more? Okay, it's time. So I've been there again, you know, since my second surrender. And so what I do is I just keep going back to the work. I talk to my sponsor. I read the book. I carry the message. I pray in the morning. I pray at night. I'm a member of a home group. I do service in my district. And I thank God so much for this today, and I thank you.
Thank you, Erica. Our next speaker is Gus from Silobe, Texas.
Morning. My name's Gus. I am an alcoholic. And from Silobe, Texas. I'm not the guy from Guatemala. So. I worked on a convention committee one time, and getting down to the last part of it, you know, where you coordinate with the hotel and everything, and everybody had something that Gus was going to do the next day. Well, Gus is going to get all the chairs, and Gus is going to do these things, and I'm saying, my God. And then I said, wait a minute, I didn't know about any of these assignments. And he said, it's the Gus that works at the hotel, not you. Okay. There's not many of us around, so you hear that name, you kind of perk up a little bit. I'm a member of the Piney Woods Group in Silobe, Texas, and also attend on a regular basis the Buna Group in Buna, Texas. And there's a couple of members back there. You know, little small towns in East Texas. My last geographic got me to Southeast Texas, and as far as I'm concerned, in the heart of Big Book AA. You know, my story, it's a lot like, you know, most alcoholics. I didn't think so when I got here, though. I got sober on December 30th of 1995. And I took my last drink that day, whatever. You know, you tell that to a normal person, they think, December 30th, that's right before New Year's Eve. I mean, shouldn't you wait till afterward? I said, you don't understand. New Year's Eve, you know, Groundhog Day, Easter, Tuesday, they didn't matter. I drank the same way every day. It's, you know, they can't identify, and I can't identify with them too well. Yeah, I have to watch my talk a little bit. My wife's here this morning, so. But anyway, grew up, you know, good home, good family. Parents did the best they could, you know. I'm not a victim of anything that happened in childhood. I did it all myself. You know, but I was a really mixed up, maladjusted young person. Yeah, as a teenager, didn't feel like I fit in. Didn't feel like I belonged out in left field. You know, just wasn't a part of anything. And I needed to be, but didn't know how to get there. You know, I felt less than. Don't know why. Felt there was something wrong with me. Didn't know what it was, and was too scared to look. You know, I covered it up with a lot of stuff. You know, I became a real good actor at an early age. You know, I'd see a group of people over here, and whatever they were into, if it was, you know, the jocks over here, okay, well, I can be a jock and go see if I can fit in with that bunch. You know, another bunch over here, the hippies, the cowboys, you know, whatever. I'll try to, you know, be what I think they want to see. And then get the heck out of there before they figure out that what I really am. I know that's a, you know, really crazy way to go through life. And I've never heard anybody describe, you know, living that way until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of the really eloquent speakers I heard, my God, they nailed it. You know, that maladjustment to life. You know, like in the Dr. Bob, or excuse me, the doctor's opinion in the Big Book, you know, where it talks about being maladjusted to life and full flight from reality. That nailed me. That was me. Been that way since I was a kid. I remember when I was about 12 years old, discovered the missing ingredients to life. You know, a guy I wasn't supposed to hang around with because he was a bad kid, got in trouble. Well, I went and found him one day. Sure enough, he turned me on to the missing ingredients to life. He had a pint of Jim Beam, I think, and some other things. And within a short period of time, you know, I felt significantly better. You know, felt, you know, less apprehensive, less afraid. Felt like I was a part of something. You know, I was in now instead of out. Yeah, didn't have any negative consequences from it. Everything went fine. Parents didn't find out. You know, you get a real positive experience like that when you're 12 years old, and I need to do this as often as I possibly can. Because I found something that worked, the booze. Heck, I was a daily drinker in high school, and didn't cause any real problems for me. Got into my 20s, work world. I was a workaholic, too. You know, things were so screwed up in my head, you know, unresolved stuff that, you know, I had to fill it up with something to stay out of my head. So I really applied myself at work and did pretty well there. And I was an alcoholic too. Functioning alcoholic for a long time. And that's a wonderful way to live. Drink like you want to, and work like you want to, and still achieve some success. And, you know, the booze covers up all the problems in your life so you don't have to deal with them anymore. You know? It's a wonderful way to live. If it was still working that way today, I'd probably still be doing it. But I think most of us can identify with that all changed. You know, it was after the booze had a hold of me. And I didn't realize how strong a hold it had. But when it, you know, we talk about the bottle turned on you. And, you know, starts taking away from you rather than giving. You know, starts being a liability rather than an asset. You know, Bill talks about in his story how liquor had become an important and exhilarating part of his life. And I experienced that. I lived it. And then all of a sudden it became a necessity. It became something you had to do. And you didn't get all the positive effects from it anymore. You know, more and more it's found myself isolation drinking. You know, couldn't be around people. I knew I was going to black out, pass out, whatever. I didn't know what I was going to do. So I really felt the need to be away from people when I drank because I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, at the end of my drinking, it was me along with a bottle of liquor in a, you know, dark room somewhere. Maybe a 40-watt light bulb so I could kind of see where I was. And that's not what I sought out of my life. You know, the stuff that had given me every answer I wanted for a long time. Now it's had me near death, really. And I didn't think there was a way out. You know, chapter 3 talks about, you know, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that one day you'll be able to control and enjoy your alcohol like you see other people doing. I was surrounded by people in the world that controlled and enjoyed their drinking. Have a little wine with dinner, a cocktail before, you know, maybe get drunk a couple of times here and there, but no big deal. And I could not pull that off. No, couldn't pull it off. I tried to, like I said in chapter 3, tried everything I could think of to make that happen. You know, where you switch brands, switch from beer to wine, whiskey, whatever. Nothing worked. Tried religion. Okay, I walked away from that when I was a kid. Maybe I'll find all the answers here. And I was wanting God to zap me, you know, so that I could control and enjoy my drinking like I saw these other people doing here, but that didn't work either. You know, it was tried a lot of geographic changes, moving from one place to the other. I didn't call them that. I knew the next city. Or the next job or whatever. I didn't have any history. It was a fresh start. Right? New hope. So, okay, I'll go over here. They don't know me here. I can, you know, I'll be. And within a short period of time, it's just like it always was. And the last geographic got me to Texas. And thank God. You know, I tried to stop drinking on my own for a couple of years, I guess, and finally, just quit trying. Gave up the fight and drank like I had to. And in my case, I know how incredibly necessary that was because I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I surrendered to it. Won't fight it anymore. And eventually, I ended up in a hospital, detoxed, and they sent me to, or they strongly suggest, you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went. I knew that's where I would end up one day. I don't know why, but I did. And I thought I knew what AA was. I thought it was a bunch of miserable people fighting the need to drink every day, all day. And they get together in these meetings and kind of comfort each other a little bit, and maybe a few of them might make it one more day. Yeah, and you go through year after year after year. And you look at these old timers, you know, they're, you know, that actually had appeal to me. You know, because I thought it was about a drinking problem. And you hear it a lot in the AA meetings, if we're not careful about what message we're carrying. Yeah, how many times do you hear people share? Yeah, I went to jail, I had DWIs, I lost my job, blah, blah, blah. Came in here, I quit drinking, and everything's fine. Okay. You know, all these things where you take the booze away and the problem goes away. I was sitting in the back of the room shaking and shivering, dying on the inside, needing a drink real bad. And hearing this stuff and thinking I'm backwards from the rest of you. Because you take the booze away from me, that this stuff inside is getting worse every day. You know, they were trying to carry the message to me, but I wasn't ready to hear it yet. I had to experience another 3 months or so of trying to do it my way. You know, listen to the recovery message and listen to what, and try to sort it out for my case, because, you know, my case was different somehow. And about 3 months of that, I couldn't stand it anymore. You know, I got to the place the last speaker talked about, you know, suicidal. Yeah, I knew if I drank again, the first thing I was going to need was going to be another one, and I knew I'd die from it. You know, it was either that or blow my brains out. All this stuff that was inside me, and I didn't know where to go for help. You know, I finally broke down and got honest with one of the guys that was trying to help me and explained it all to him. You know, how mixed up and maladjusted I'd been my whole life. You know, all this crazy stuff going on in my head. You know, I didn't know, couldn't differentiate reality and fantasy anymore. I wasn't sure about what was right and wrong. And I was really keeping a low profile with God because I was such a disgusting mess. I didn't think I was worthy. I figured I had to, you know, become near perfect before God would accept me. But I just mixed up about so much. And I was telling this old guy that one night, and he shook his head and he said, "Gus," he said, "there's nothing wrong with you but untreated alcoholism. You've been around here for, you know, 3 or 4 months trying to figure this thing out, come up with your own program of recovery. Yeah, and you're dying. You know, if you're not through drinking, go on out there and get after it. We'll be here if you make it back." He nailed me that night. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, "You know, AA's going to get along just fine without you, but I don't think you're going to make it without us." And he left, got in his truck and drove off. I'd already experienced step one, part A, about booze. Now I absolutely understood step one, part B. And I needed a solution so bad. And I knew it wasn't going to come from inside me. And I knew that whatever it was, I didn't have to understand it. That's when I was ready to hear the message. Went to a meeting the next day. I call it D meeting. You know, thought maybe it was going to be my last. Kind of dramatic the way I look at things. But, you know, this doesn't work today. I'm going to take my life. But I went to that meeting, and they opened it up, and the guy started sharing about 20 minutes and told my story from one end to the other. Not just the drinking part, but all the way of mind work, the things he'd done in his life, and the reasons why, underlying motivations and fears. He nailed me, buddy. And it went around the room. Everybody did. And they finally called on me, and I was just dumbfounded. I said, "You people won't believe how much we have in common." You know, I identified. I mean, I was in the right place, in the right room, the right people. You know, I'm just like them. They're like me. You know? And they weren't talking about my story. They were talking about their own. That's what we do in AA. If I go to a doctor and I got a problem, he gets out his clipboard and that looks at my medical history and where does it hurt, you know, how much do you do? You know, he asks questions and diagnoses me and comes up with a solution. You know, in AA, you know, somebody comes to us with a problem, we go on a 12-step call. Okay, the other person talks a little bit, but then we quickly get them out of that and start talking about our own stuff. Let me tell you a little bit about my story. See if we can't find a place for you to hook on here. Yeah, if you're an alcoholic, you're going to identify with this. We tell our stories. You know, that's the hook right there. You know, that meeting where I identified with AA and the AA people. You know, right after that, I was getting to where I could read and understand the literature a little bit. Found myself in the big book. We drink essentially because of the effect produced. Yeah, that's me. Maladjusted to life in full flight from reality. That's me. Read about the real alcoholic on page 21. That's me. You know, read about the bedevilments, page 52. You know, oh my God, couldn't control our emotional natures, full of fear, prey to misery and depression. Wow, they nailed me. Get over to A Vision for You. It talks about the disease, you know. Subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, come to know loneliness such as few people do. I said, my, whoever wrote this book lived my life. And they hooked me. They identified. Once enough of my pride and self-reliance collapsed because y'all were sharing your experience and your message, I could identify with it. I knew I was in the right room. You know, I'm working with other people today. You never know. You never know where you're going to go, what you're going to end up with, whatever. But most of the time you go call on a drunk, they want to do a lot of talking. Yeah, y'all been on those 12-step calls? Or they call you on the phone and want to talk, you know. Yeah. I listen for a while because I know we all got to vent. But when it turns to whining, you know, turns to I'm a victim, I say, okay, let me give you a couple things to think about. I'll jump into my story. Maybe a part of my story is kind of where they are, or whatever it is going on in life. And I'll just start letting that come out as it will. Let God work through us, you know. And if they're ready to hear the message, they'll listen. Wow, that happened to me too. Oh my God, I thought I was the only one. Not ready to hear the message, they'll cut you off and go back into their own stuff. Probably experience those too. You know, I was near death when I got here, and I didn't think there was a way out. You know, I heard y'all talk about this spiritual awakening, you know, relationship with God, conscious contact, and things that just I couldn't grasp because I never experienced it. You know, but when I finally could identify it with you and trust you and do it your way, it worked just like you said it would. Thank you.
Thank you, Gus. You know, it's a lot of discussion here about the language of the heart, and that's what it's all about. Our final speaker today, I was really glad to see him come in. You just don't know. I never met him before, but I was truly happy when he came in. My delegate gave me the blues for not wearing a suit, so thank God for Dean B. from San Diego, California.
Awesome. Hi, everybody. My name is Dean, and I'm alcoholic. And it just blows me away. This is my first international convention, and I will get emotional. I'm going to tell you that in advance, but I'll take a couple pauses, and we'll get through it. I'm so thankful you're all here today. We're here together. I came in a little late. Actually, I showed up really early, and there was hardly anybody in the room, and I went out just to calm my thoughts and just kick back. And my tendency would be to chart out everything, you know, which I wrote down some notes, but to continue doing that and until I come in here. And I had the pleasure of meeting another new friend, I think, possibly in for a long time while I was sitting out there. And we were just, you know, kind of sitting there looking the opposite way. And then before you know it, you shake each other's hand. And I was just amazed because within about 5 minutes, we were exchanging stories. And this person, relatively new in the program, didn't see how he could identify. And, you know, by the time we're right in the middle of the story when my wife comes out and says, the meeting's already started. And that's been the story of this convention for me around. I tried to pay attention to the speakers. Thank you so much for trudging the way here today before me. But I also tried to look out at as many faces as possible. Because before Alcoholics Anonymous, before recovery, there was a wall up when I would go to talk to you. Even in early recovery, it was very unusual for me to be able to connect with anybody. My sobriety date, by the way, is September 21st, 1997. And I truly was flabbergasted about this topic because it has been a big part of why I'm standing here today. Growing up, I relate to what I've heard so far. Is, you know, I just felt I was in fear all the time. I was, believe it or not, I was small at one time, a small, frail kid, and you know, there was a lot of things about me physically that were different, a lot of things mentally. I grew up in a very chaotic home. Don't blame any of that on my alcoholism. But the reason I bring it up is because there was, each one of these things was layers that by the time I realized that there was a possible solution through alcohol, it was more justification for, if it worked, great. I remember my dad, who was a heavy drinker to this day. I don't know whether he was an alcoholic. I really have not ever been able to identify somebody else as an alcoholic until they tell me their story and identify themselves. But he had a beer a day, and he would have the beer sitting in the next to the easy chair, and he'd go out of the room for something, and you know, at 4 or 5 years old, I'd wonder what that was. And at one point, you know, he came back in the room when I was trying to take a little taste. And I remember him saying, be careful, Dean, don't let that creep up on you. You know, I wondered what he was talking about. It never did creep up on me. It was just a kid taking a taste of beer when he shouldn't. In my teenage years, when kids are out getting in trouble, doing what we do, I still wasn't in any active alcoholism as a teenager, but I had started drinking. The first time I really drank, about the age of 13, I look back, though, and realize some of the problems of body I had. The beginning of the problem of body that's part of our illness, in that I was at my older sister's party. She was about 7 years older, so these are 18, 19-year-olds. They had beer and wine at the party. And I said to a friend of my sister's, I want to get drunk. And before you know it, somebody's pouring me a glass of wine. Why they're giving a kid 13 a glass of wine, I can't second guess that, but they did, and I was glad. And it was a tall glass of wine for a young kid, and I'm nothing happened. And people are asking, well, how do you feel? I don't really feel any different. And so another glass of wine. How do you feel? I don't know. When's it going to start? So I took the third or fourth tall glass of wine, and I don't remember anything else after that. I do remember them telling me the next day different things, you know. But I didn't feel like drinking the next day. I looked at it as kind of an interesting experience. And I dabbled with different things through my teenage years. My drinking really accelerated when I got a job in the middle of nowhere in Nevada. And there was drinking 24 hours. I was contracted to the Air Force, and they have different shifts, and they have bars open for all hours. And my drinking started to accelerate to the point to where I would start to come into work drunk. For a while, I considered it a hangover, tried to convince myself it was a hangover. But eventually, I realized, wow, this is 10:30 in the morning, Dean, and you're drunk. So, like others in here, I did find some solutions to that. And this is a singleness of purpose program. I'm not going to get into the special effects. I did start going really fast at times. And there were a SWAT team or two on the roof. But what I found was, throughout my life, I'm going to compress the story because we don't have a lot of time today. But throughout my life, whenever the special effects were removed, I could not stay away from the next drink. In fact, at one point, I thought it was a solution because I had done so much of this other stuff that, like a friend told me one time, Dean, here's a solution. Just drink and go to church.
Yeah.
Okay. So that wasn't even the beginning of a bottom when I would show up to work drunk. There was two places to drink. You could either drink on base or little town 40-50 miles away. And I still continue to do very dangerous things in regard to alcohol. I showed up one morning coming back through the base at like 5 a.m. My daily regimen over time was show up at 4:35 to my room on base, take a cold shower. I can't count how many months, days in a row, that was my daily routine, is get in at 5:30, cold shower, get to work at 6:30, realize you're still drunk at 10:30 in the morning. I'm not going to do this again. I can't do this anymore. Until 3 or 4 that afternoon when everybody was going back into town. That was the early 80s, and problems of alcohol were tolerated a little bit differently than they are today. And I did the next best thing, and I took a geographic. I would respond to each life happening that was negative to drink more, move. Drink more, move. I didn't lose a lot of jobs, but I do have many jobs where the reason they know I'm gone is because there's a box. And it contains all the stuff from when I left in a very quick fashion. And I went from Nevada to Denver, and the special effects were still present. The SWAT teams were still present. And I was told on one hospital visit for psychosis. They called it chemically induced psychosis. To this day, as I was sharing with my friend David, even though I know the stuff wasn't real, I had gotten to a point to where reality, it was really hard to differentiate reality, difference between reality and fiction. And they let me out of that hospital. They didn't carry the message to me. I don't know if I would have heard it if they did carry it. And I would continue to dig deeper and deeper. Thankfully, there was just one last geographic change in my life about ready to happen. Before that geographic change, I had the business I was associated with. I was owner of a small business. And just like the book says, I worked for a concern I once owned, a business concern I once owned. That was me. Right before I made my last geographic, I was actually working for the person I had trained into that job as owner of the business, and the financial backer had taken over. And if that's not a little sidetrack, when I came in here, I did not know what paradigm of wonderfulness was, but I knew pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that day, before I made the geographic, when I came into to work, and they handed me the box, one more box, in front of all my customers, and they said, "You got 5 minutes." And I left. On the way out of the door to my business and getting out of the building, the sheriffs were there with another unrelated warrant. It was actually just identification of a civil thing pending. I always had civil things pending, you know, back in the day. And before I made this geographic, the point I'm trying to make is that owner of the business who was sober, I dropped him off at the recovery place that eventually helped him get sober, not just as a friend. Now he's 12-stepping me. I didn't know it at the time, but he said, "There's a meeting." I didn't want to go to the meeting. I wanted him off my back. And so I said, "Yep, I'll go to the meeting." Now, I didn't intend to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And I went into this small room. It's one of those storefront where they might fit about 50 people, and there's a coffee thing in the back. And I gravitated to the coffee. I don't drink coffee, but I needed to be near something. And a gentleman made me feel comfortable. And it turns out that later on, I'd ask this guy that was trying to 12-step me, "Well, what happened to Brad?" "Well, he doesn't come all the time. He's a local homeless guy from the neighborhood that lives in back of the dumpster." Now, I would have many more bottoms after that. It wasn't the end for me. I'd go to another state. I'd dig deeper. And I did eventually blindly reach out for help to get some help after that. And be introduced back to family, back to life, back to you guys. And there are miracles beyond belief that I don't have time to share today. But I will tell you, anything that has happened in my life of any worth, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, as a result of that homeless man befriending me. I don't think he stayed sober. He hadn't been sober by the time I left Denver. He was MIA. But he carried a message to me and identified with me, even though I didn't identify with them. When I would eventually get sober and be recommended that I be back in Nevada near a son, which is a whole other part of recovery that's been restored, is a relationship with my son, I wound up at the funnest group in Alcoholics Anonymous. They had a way of taking the most sordid stories, the most sordid truths you could say about yourself, and making you feel welcome and a part of. So one thing I thought when I had this topic was, it's nice to say the words. I can look up the definition, which, by the way, one of the definitions I found is of identification is the transferring of a response from one situation to another because the two bear similar circumstances. So now I get to relate to that 60-year-old grandmother that took her first drink when she retired. And now she's 70, 75, and all of a sudden it's caught up with her. I don't need to think that that person needs the same experience that I need to be able to identify and carry this message to her. In Las Vegas, 2 years in sobriety, I would blindly reach out for the first time. And I, in 2 years of not drinking, yes, I got sober and I didn't take the steps. After all that had happened, I blindly reached out. And I, for the first time, I didn't look for the president of AA. And he told me the importance of, Dean, we're going to go through every sentence in this book. And you must be able to identify with every part. Because if you can't identify with every part in some way, you're not going to be able to carry this message. It will be your own message. So I'm very thankful for him teaching me that. We're at the funnest group in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got characters. I heard him say Big Ed. We had the Commissioner of Fun, who would open every meeting with, "Welcome to the second chance of life." We'd have the crying cowboy with 35 years of sobriety that said, "You've got to want this thing so bad, as if your head was in a bucket of water and you were grasping for your last breath." We'd have Wino Ed that would say, "You've got to be so desperate. I wish you the gift of desperation like I had when I put the gun in my mouth and I could still taste the oil when I got to my first meeting." And you know what? They weren't just stories. So they heard me tell my story, and I didn't feel quite a part of. And there's a part of my story where I'm homeless. I did wind up with at Alcoholics Anonymous without a key to a place. And you guys see that small duffel bag sitting at the edge of there? They called me Duffel Bag. And so I'm so thankful that, and I felt a part of, so I'm so thankful that they found a way to identify with me, help me identify with others, because I'm standing here today. My life is everything it's been because of you guys, Alcoholics Anonymous, and your ability to help me identify, look you in the eye, and say, "My name is Dean, I'm alcoholic." Thank you.
I'd like to thank Dean and all the rest of the speakers. There's a microphone about halfway up the aisle there. And we're going to open the floor now for comments, briefly. About 3 minutes, please. I guess that will be really brief. Nobody has anything to say. We'll close it.
Good morning. My name's Peter. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Peter.
My home group meets in Christchurch, New Zealand, and it's called Waikiki South. We've come a long way for this meeting. It's been great to hear it, and it's been a great subject, and that's just why I wanted to comment on the subject. Because when I made contact with Alcoholics Anonymous, it was through a guy who wasn't an alcoholic. But he said, I asked him the question, I said, "Do you think I am an alcoholic?" He said, "Well," he said, "I don't know." He said, "But the evidence looks pretty good." He said, "I'll get a real one to come and talk to you." I qualified to be here on step one, well and truly. And so when this character came around and sat in my house, I thought, my God, this fella I told all my life story to has opened his big trap and told this character, who's a complete stranger, and I didn't particularly like the look of him, but as soon as he opened his mouth, the end of the isolation was over. I knew there was another human being. I identified all right with that guy, and I accepted what he had. And of course, in the course of the conversation, at the end of the day, he said, I had a bottle of beer in my refrigerator with the condensation running down it. I can still see it if I really focus. But I really wanted to get into that. And he said, before you take the top off, he said, ring me up. And I thought, why? And he said, well, better to talk to me than take the top off the bottle. And I did through the course of that night when I was hallucinating and DTs and all those evil things we have, when I'd had before. And I knew the bottle of beer would fix it. But this guy, I rang him up to tell him how I was going, and I couldn't get a word in. He just, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. He got me through the night without taking the top off, and a lot have happened since then, and that was 36 years ago. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Diana Shepherd. Well, Diana. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Diana.
From where am I from here? Houston, Texas. I'm really from Alabama. And I travel a lot of places. But, you know, I came in AA and I was in denial. I knew I was an alcoholic, but I didn't know what that meant. You know, my favorite chapter, one of my favorite chapters in the big book is Dr. Bob's Nightmare. And he states in there that he had read many books. He had talked to a lot of people. But until he met a man that had the same drunkard experiences that he had had, identification is extremely important. I have other things wrong, but I come to AA for my sobriety. I go other places. I talk to other people for other things. You see, I'm overweight. I'm 100 pounds fatter than I was when I came in here. But that's okay. But I come in here to identify. I come to AA meetings to identify, and I come for the solution, an Alcoholics Anonymous. Not until I came here, I thought people got drunk. They went to a treatment. They taught them how to drink, and they started over again. And some people just didn't get it. And I identify with a vision for you, because I was one of those people until I was 28. I got married in Las Vegas, and I was the one that could not drink one drink. I was the one that let it sit there until it just melted. And people would make fun of me, you know, until I had problems and they built up on me, and I knew that alcohol would solve it. But anyway, I had no idea about this program. And when I stopped drinking and I hit my bottom, I jumped in this program like white on rice. I wanted to know everything about how I could stay sober one day at a time. And I still try to do those things today. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Janine, and I am an alcoholic. And I am from Alabama. But I'm actually here with a bunch of girls that I got sober with in West Hartford, Connecticut. And they saved my life through identification. I came to AA for months without thinking I was an alcoholic. I just didn't want to be in trouble anymore. And then one night we were reading a story out of the big book about some old guy. And I didn't think there was possible for me to identify. I was always looking for the reasons I didn't belong here. You know, I hadn't lost my house. I hadn't lost the husband that I hadn't achieved yet. I had a job. So what if I was getting close to getting fired? Like, I had all this stuff that I thought you needed to be an adult. But these women started talking about how they identified with the story, and they started talking about the stuff in their lives that made them relate to the guy in the story, and they had all said they were alcoholics. And as they went around the room and they said the stuff that I was thinking, that I was always too afraid to say out loud, it occurred to me that I might be an alcoholic too. And it wasn't until they were brave enough to say what was going on with them that I was able to, like, latch onto that. And I came to AA for months feeling lost and feeling like maybe this isn't going to work for me. And it wasn't until my ears opened and I heard them identify with what was going on rather than compare. And the second experience I had with identification was when I did my fifth step, and I did the steps to prove that they didn't work. I was going to be the person that it didn't work for, and be like, rarely have we seen a person fail, except for Janine. My first sponsor heard my fifth step, and through a lot of it, she said, "Me too." me too, and those are the sweetest words in the English language. I absolutely love them. It made me question if she should be sponsoring anyone, but that's a different story for a different day. But I've had the experience of being able to do that for other people and seeing the eyes open and say, like, how do you know? Because I'm an alcoholic. And because if you've ever experienced that stuff, you probably are too. You know, people that aren't alcoholics don't have to spend a lot of time trying to figure it out. And, you know, I had somebody say that to me after my very first meeting, and it didn't click until after being around for a while. Identification is really important to me because it took so long for me to get that. I know how precious it is. And it took a lot of women beating me over the head with their identification before I went, oh, okay. And it saved my life, and I'm truly grateful. So thank you.
My name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
And I'm from Oregon. And I went into a treatment center to correct my behavior problems. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. My last drink, I woke up on a Sunday morning, opened up the refrigerator, grabbed 2 dozen colored Easter eggs and a six-pack of Budweiser, and went in the backyard to hide Easter eggs for my 2 boys. And 9:30, my wife was yelling at me, and the kids were crying because I couldn't remember where I hid the eggs. But I remember sitting on my back porch, wondering what's wrong with me. Why do I continue to hurt the people who love me the most? And that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And next morning, my wife dropped me off at a treatment center. And everybody was walking around with these blue books talking about these 12 stairs and stuff. And I didn't know what they were talking about. And I called my parents up in California, and I told them where I was at. I was 34. And my mom's crying, my dad's crying, and my mom says, call your little brother and tell him where you're at. And my little brother, Mike, I hadn't seen in over a year younger than me. So she gave me his phone number. I called my brother, and I'm telling him, you know, I'm sleeping on the couch. The wife's about ready to throw me out. I'm in this treatment center. He's cracking up. He thinks it's funny. And I finally say, why are you laughing at me, Mike? He says, because 9 months ago, I did the same thing you're doing right now, Dave. My little brother had been sober 9 months in Southern California. And he says, why don't I come up and see you in treatment? And I said, sure, yeah, nobody's going to come see me anyway. So he drove up. He was 9 months sober. And we sat in this room up in that treatment center, and he had his big book. And he told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me what his drinking was like. And he gave me the solution to the problem of drink. And in that room, I cut alcoholism from my little brother. And next Wednesday, he'll be 23 years sober. And he still has 9 months on me.
Morning. My name's Joe Anderson. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Joe.
From Florida, transplant from Fairfield, Connecticut. And my friend Peter, we rode in from the airport the other day. I haven't had to have a drink since March the 8th, 1985, and I've never had to go back out and try it again. But I went to a 21-day program, and I got out of that program, and I came home. And my wife said to me, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to go to a meeting. And the first meeting I went to, I hated everybody there. Come home. My wife said, now what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to another meeting tonight. Well, that was the turning point. It was a speaker meeting. I ended up joining this group. And I heard this guy, Mike Baranski. And it was his 7th anniversary. And I came home from that meeting, and my wife said, well, what do you think? I said, I have heard somebody who is as crazy as I am. I said, I got a shot at this thing. And that was the turning point for me, you know, first day out of rehab. It gave me something to come back. It was the identification with another drunk who was just as nuts as I was, you know. And he was working on it a day at a time. And that's all we got. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Pete. I'm from Willoughby, Ohio. Home group New Beginnings East at Laurelwood Hospital. And that's the hospital I did rehab in about 10 years ago, a little more than that. And when I was strongly suggested by my employer to go to this hospital, they set it up with HR and the EAP and everything. I heard the word hospital, and I knew my body was beat, and it was because of drinking too much. But if they would have told me it was a rehab center, I probably would have just been fired. I said, no, I'm not going to rehab. But fortunately, thankfully, my body was beat up enough that I went. And when I first checked in there and met all the junkies and winos and felons that were up on the floor with me, I tried to tell them that they made a mistake and I should be across the hall, and you know, and where all the sick people are. So they took me down to my first AA meeting, actually pushed me in a wheelchair. But I really got identified with what Gus said about page 30 and 31 when they gave me a big book. I was like, okay, whatever. And I got to that page and read the part about the obsession of every abnormal drinker to control his drinking, and then on and on. And I got really scared after that. I didn't want to read that big book anymore because I wanted to hold on to the idea that I was unique and this was like, you know, reading the prophecies of Nostradamus or something. So I stayed away from that big book, but I stuck around long enough to get it once it started to feel good. And pretty soon I met other people I could identify with between my physical problems, the gout, and just drinking beer and all this other stuff. But I think if it weren't for identification and the ability to know I'm not alone, I probably wouldn't be here today. Thanks.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you all for sharing. We're going to have to clear this room for the next meeting to follow. So if you would, could we please close with a serenity prayer?